But these that excuse might not be accepted by God. But then the following verse reads, إِلَّا الْمُسَدْعَفِينَ مِنَ الرِّجَالِ وَالنِّسَاءِ وَالْوِلْدَانِ لَا يَسْتَتِعُونَ حِيلَةً وَلَا يَهْتَدُونَ سَبِيلًا. Except the oppressed, again this translation, which might be better to say deprived, except the deprived among men, women, and children who have neither access to any means nor are guided to any way.
So thank you for your nice explanations. We will follow this discussion on the next session, inshallah. So you are listening to Arab English Radio. I hope today's episode was fruitful enough to help you with a better understanding of Islamic concept. For more information, you can visit parstoday.com. Until next session and a new episode of Q&A on Islamic Belief, may Allah protect and bless you all.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن.
Saudi ties with the United States. Part 1.
Well, the long classified pages detailing alleged ties of the Saudi Arabian government to the 9/11 hijackers have now been released by Congress.
They confirm what many have suspected all along, that the 9/11 hijackers...
15 years after the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government finally released a long-classified parts of an official report on an inquiry into its intelligence community activities before and after the attacks. Those parts were 28 out of hundreds of pages that provided details about the incident and results of the inquiry. According to these 28 pages, a number of officials of the Saudi embassy in Washington and its affiliated institutes had close ties with people involved in hijacking commercial planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center in New York City. The officials had helped the hijackers travel, reside, study, and even receive driving education in the U.S. 15 out of 19 people who carried out the 9/11 attacks were Saudi citizens. But for everyone, especially the families of the victims, it was very strange that what made different American administrations, from Democrat to Republican, act so cautiously in this regard. Years on, those families, as well as journalists and observers, are still confused about such stance. It seems strange for everyone that where this bond began and how it grew that has granted such immunity to Saudi Arabia
whose relationship still continues with the U.S. despite the fact that thousands of Americans were killed in the 9/11 attacks. The Saudi story begins in this city. Today, Riyadh is a modern city with very beautiful buildings as well as wide and long highways. Images of the king and the young crown prince can be seen everywhere. A crown prince who's an exception in the 100-year history of the Saudi royal family. No one has so far got the chance to acquire this position at this age. Of course, everything was different in the days when Al Saud decided to conquer this city to expand its rule all over the region that today is known as Saudi Arabia. In those days, different tribes were living in Najd and Hejaz regions, which were fighting for their survival, and Al Saud was one of those tribes. Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman bin Saud was the one who decided to wage a war in the early years of the 20th century. To fulfill his dreams, he needed a sword that could defeat all tribes, and at that time, this sword belonged to the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was the name of a group of people who were staunch followers of Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab. They were very warlike and merciless, and that was exactly what Al Saud needed. The bond between Al Saud and Abd al-Wahhab, which existed for more than 100 years, had become stronger and helped Abdulaziz conquer Riyadh in 1902. The conflict continued until a few years after the end of the First World War, and Abdulaziz declared his rule on the entire Saudi Arabia in 1926 after defeating Hejaz ruler Sharif Hussein. Al Saud felt indebted to the Brotherhood, whose position was increasingly improving in this family. In 1932, Abdulaziz bin Saud put the name of his clan on a country that today we know as Saudi Arabia and officially declared its existence. Several years after Abdulaziz took power in Saudi Arabia, the number of pilgrims of Hajj, which was one of the main sources of income for the Saudi ruler, began to decrease due to a global financial crisis that erupted in the U.S. In 1929, the number of Hajj pilgrims was about 130,000, which was reduced to 40,000 two years later. The financial situation of Abdulaziz was so bad in those days that he told one of his American friends, Philby, that he would give any concessions to anyone giving him ₹1 million. Al Saud had come to power with the help of the merciless Brotherhood and apparently needed them to survive. But the Saudi royal family had to find a new way to pay the country's expenses, and at that time, oil was the best solution. In the early 1930s, many countries were trying to sign contracts with the Al Saud that was already in possession of vast oil resources. During that time, there was stiff competition between British and American companies for taking oil exploration patents. Finally, on May 29, 1933, and after weeks of negotiations with Saudi officials, representatives of the American company Standard Oil of California signed a contract with the Saudi king for the oil exploration in Saudi Arabia. American experts began exploring oil in the heat of scorching deserts of Saudi Arabia, and in 1938, and after 5 years of exploring, they gained their first achievement in Dammam area, a few kilometers north of the city of Dhahran and at the seventh drilling site. But the beginning of the story of the U.S. and Al Saud family dates back to the final days of the Second World War. That's when then-U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was returning from the Yalta Conference on the Crimean Peninsula. There, he, along with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, had shared the spoils of war, especially in Europe, several days before. When USS Quincy, the ship carrying Roosevelt, reached the Suez Canal, it made a short stop at Bitter Lake so that he could meet with a number of Arab and African leaders, the most important of whom was Abdulaziz bin Saud, the king of the newly established country of Saudi Arabia. A warship had gone to Jeddah to bring Abdulaziz to the Suez Canal. Abdulaziz had told everyone that he was heading for Mecca, and until the last moment, nobody knew that the destination was the pier of Jeddah. Abdulaziz, leading a 48-member delegation of his aides, entered Quincy to officially meet with one of the world's leaders outside of Saudi Arabia. The meeting took place on February the 14th. The most important lines of discussions between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud on board their ship have to date determined the main structure of political ties between the U.S. and Al Saud. The U.S. demanded oil, and Al Saud was in need of security. Following the U.S. economic crisis in the 1930s, Roosevelt was making industrial and economic reforms for 13 years and knew that his country required vast oil resources, especially after the end of World War II, and Saudi Arabia was the country which could meet that requirement. In return, Abdulaziz demanded the U.S. improve his country's security and provide it with the technology needed to make changes on the condition that the U.S. does not interfere in Saudi Arabia's internal affairs, especially religious issues. Saudi Arabia's religious structure, which was based on Wahhabi ideology, was very impervious and fiercely resisted any change or signs from a foreign culture. Sometime after the meeting between Abdulaziz and Roosevelt, during which the alliance between the two countries became stronger, a flow of American advisors in different fields headed to Saudi Arabia to prepare the grounds for the presence of thousands of Americans and their families in the future. Even the presence of these experts was not to the liking of strict Wahhabi leaders, who strongly expressed their displeasure and informed the king of it. The Wahhabi leaders knew that the presence of those advisors would result in changes that are inconsistent with their ideology. Abdulaziz, who had no other way but to invite the American advisors, tried to convince the religious leaders. He cited Prophet Muhammad's cooperation with Christians as an indication legitimizing the presence of the American advisors in Saudi Arabia. With the discovery of new oil fields and extracting more oil, the image of Saudi Arabia began to change, and Saudi rulers, who once lived in deserts, moved to their new palaces. The most important economic income of Saudi Arabia was now from two key sources. One was the annual Hajj pilgrimage that each year attracted millions of Muslims from across the world, and the other one was a precious treasure called oil that lied beneath the sands of this land and made Saudi Arabia one of the richest countries in the world. The middle years of the 20th century marked a period when communist thinking was growing across the world, and at the same time, Arab countries were witnessing a rise in nationalism and pan-Arabism. Both were not to the liking of Saudi authorities and influential clerics, and therefore could not be welcomed in Saudi Arabia. After Gamal Abdel Nasser Hussein came to power in Egypt, and following challenges between him and Muslim Brotherhood supporters, Saudi Arabia opened its doors to the elite of this group so that they can live and work there. Any specialist, from medics to engineers and teachers, was allowed to go to Saudi Arabia. The bulk of those migrants were teachers and university lecturers who left a significant impact on future generations in Saudi Arabia. Based on extreme Wahhabi views, Muslim Brotherhood supporters were also considered strangers, but at least they were Muslims and better than Western infidels. The immigration of Muslim Brotherhood supporters from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan to Saudi Arabia during the 1960s and 70s left a significant impact on the Saudi society in the years that followed. One of those people was Abdullah Yusuf Azam, a scholar who years later played a key role in the formation of militant groups in Islamic countries. In 1973, Arabs and Israel fought a war known as October War. Arab countries were seeking to make up for the defeat they suffered during a six-day war with Israel several years before. Egypt from the south and Syria from the north launched a lightning attack on Israel. Arab countries made gains in the early days of war. That prompted the U.S. to intervene in support of Israel. the largest logistical line was set up to supply Israel with new weapons and change the balance of war, and that assistance turned to be working. In response, Arab countries halted oil exports in support of Egypt and Syria, and as a result, an unprecedented shock pushed oil prices up. The oil prices that did not increase by even a cent in the 1960s suddenly jumped from $3 to $12 a barrel. That was a record price in the market. The economic pressure caused by oil sanctions was so severe that the U.S. was even mulling over military action against Saudi Arabia. But the plan was never implemented after oil sanctions were lifted in March of 1974. Even after the war ended, the world was still grappling with the impacts of the shock caused by high oil prices, but oil-exporting countries gained wealth they had never seen before, and Saudi Arabia naturally was at the top of these countries. The pumping of so much money into Saudi Arabia changed its social image in the years that followed. The most important feature of that change was a tendency to modern Western lifestyle, something which many Wahhabi religious centers in Saudi Arabia were unhappy with. A society which had reacted angrily to the advent of television 10 years before in 1965 was now facing a storm of change. Cities were expanding and new buildings were being constructed one after another. During these years, many families were making a huge profit from construction across Saudi Arabia, and the Bin Laden family was one of them. The Bin Ladens had come close with the royal family, which helped it sign many contracts to carry out development projects, including the one to develop and renovate Masjid al-Haram, or the Sacred Mosque.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important question, and that question is about the meaning of the word zuhud, or asceticism. As you know, asceticism, or zuhud, is one of the primary and most central Islamic virtues, and it's been encouraged by, you know, the Holy Quran and the Hadith, and also the great saints within the history of Islam. But unfortunately, there's a lot of ambiguity surrounding the meaning of the word asceticism in Zuhud. And the reason for this is that we see that, unfortunately, in Islamic history, a lot of people now, sometimes with good intentions and sometimes with incorrect intentions, they adopted a form of asceticism, right, under the influence of foreign factors. You know that in a lot of religions, the concept of relinquishing the world, right, it has a very specific form, in the sense that, for example, we see that a lot of Buddhist monks, you know, they relinquish the world. How do they do that? For example, they go and live in a monastery in the mountains. They never get married, right? They don't work, right? They just, you know, go from house to house begging, you know, and that's how they, and they spend their time meditating, right, in the mountains. And you know, this is their form of asceticism, right? This is their form of zuhud. Or like, for example, we see in some religions such as Jainism, right? The relinquishing of the world is, it goes to the extreme of the person not even wearing clothes, right? For example, he walks around naked, you know, in the streets. He doesn't have a, he doesn't have a house, he doesn't have clothes, he doesn't even have clothes, right? So, you know, so these are forms of asceticism. And in Islamic history, unfortunately, when Muslims came into contact, right, through wars and through the influx of foreigners in Islamic lands and in the Arabian Peninsula, with these different religions and these different ideologies and different philosophies, a lot of times, right, these different ideologies and philosophies and religions, they had an effect on the Muslims, right? And a lot of people, you know, they adopted concepts that, from those religions, those ideologies, and asceticism. The asceticism that some Muslims adopted incorrectly was because of this. Right? So this has created an ambiguity in this word. In this word, fortunately, our Aimma alayhi salam, under the light of the guidance of the Holy Quran, have elucidated the meaning of what asceticism is. For example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following: asceticism, zuhud, is the key to the door of the hereafter and immunity from the fire. And it is to abandon all those things that preoccupy you from Allah, neither experiencing regret upon their loss, nor self-admiration for having abandoned them, nor awaiting deliverance from them, nor seeking praise on account of them, and nor anything else in exchange for them. Rather, you see their loss as a source of comfort and their presence as a source of misfortune, such that you consistently run away from misfortune and seek refuge in comfort. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meaning of asceticism in Islam under the guidance of the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The West seems more fixated on spending social wealth on the military rather than addressing the climate catastrophe. The money that is being poured into the Western military establishments does not only drift away from any climate spending, but also promotes greater climate catastrophe. The U.S. military is the largest institutional polluter on the planet. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Murad Qureshi, a former member of the London Assembly and a former chairman of the Stop the War Coalition, titled $2 Trillion for War versus $100 Billion to Save the Planet. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. During late April and early May, South Asia experienced the terrible impacts of global warming. Temperatures reached almost 50 degrees Celsius in some cities in the region. These high temperatures came alongside dangerous flooding in northeast India and in Bangladesh, as the rivers burst their banks, with flash floods occurring in such places as Sunamganj in Sylhet, Bangladesh. Samuel Haque, the director of the International Center of Climate Change and Development, is from Bangladesh. He's a veteran of the UN climate negotiations. When Haque read a tweet by Marianne Carlson, the co-chairwoman of the UN's Adaptation Committee, which said that more time is needed to reach an agreement while referring to the negotiations on loss and damage finance, he tweeted, "The one thing we have run out of is time. Climate change impacts are already happening, and poor people are suffering losses and damages due to the emissions of the rich. Talk is no longer an acceptable substitute for action." Carlson's comment came in light of the trickle slow process of agreement on the loss and damage agenda for the 27th Conference of Parties, meeting to be held in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, this November. In 2009, at COP15, developed countries of the world had agreed to a $100 billion annual adaptation assistance fund, which was supposed to be paid by 2020. This fund was intended to help countries of the Global South to shift their reliance on carbon to renewable sources of energy and to adapt to the realities of the climate catastrophe. However, at the time of the Glasgow COP26 meeting in November 2021, developed countries were unable to meet this commitment. The $100 billion may seem like a modest fund, but is far less than the $1 trillion climate finance challenge that will be required to ensure comprehensive climate action. The richer states led by the West have not only refused to fund adaptation seriously, but they have also reneged on the original agreements such as the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. Congress has refused to ratify this important step toward mitigating the climate crisis. The United States has shifted the goalpost for reducing its methane emissions and has refused to account for the massive output of carbon emissions by the U.S. military. Germany hosts the Secretariat of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. In June, as a prelude to COP27, the UN held a conference in Bonn on climate change. The talks ended in acrimony over the finance for what is known as loss and damage. The European Union consistently blocked all discussions on compensation. Eddie Press of the Climate Action Network in Canada said, "Consumed by their narrow interest, rich nations, and in particular countries in the European Union, came to the Bonn Climate Conference to block, delay, and undermine efforts from people and communities on the front lines addressing the losses and damage caused by fossil fuels. On the table is the hypocrisy of countries such as Germany, which claims to lead on these issues, but instead has been sourcing fossil fuels overseas and has been spending increasing funds on its military. At the same time, these countries have denied support to developing countries, facing devastation from climate-induced superstorms and rising seas. After the recent German elections, hopes were raised that the new coalition of the Social Democrats with the Green Party would lift up the green agenda. However, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has promised 100 billion euros for the military, the biggest increase in the country's military expenditure since the end of the Cold War. He has also committed to spending more than 2% of the country's gross domestic product on the military. This means more money for the military and less money for climate mitigation and green transformation." The money that is being poured into the Western military establishments does not only drift away from any climate spending, but also promotes greater climate catastrophe. The U.S. military is the largest institutional polluter on the planet. The maintenance of its more than 800 military bases around the world, for instance, means that the U.S. military consumes 395,000 barrels of oil daily. In 2021, the world's governments spent $2 trillion on weapons, with the leading country being those that are the richest, as well as the most sanctimonious on the climate debate. Money is available for war, but not to deal with the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi wrote, "The way weapons have poured into Ukraine conflict gives many of us pause." According to the Hunger Hotspots report by the United Nations agencies, the prolongation of that war has placed 49 million more people at risk of famine in 46 countries. Conflict and organized violence were the main sources of food insecurity in Africa and West Asia, specifically in northern Nigeria, Central Sahel, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and Syria. The conflict in Eastern Europe has exacerbated the food crisis by driving up the price of agricultural commodities. Russia and Ukraine together account for around 30% of the global wheat trade. So the longer the conflict continues, the more hunger hotspots will grow, taking food insecurity beyond just Africa and West Asia. While one COP meeting has already taken place on the African continent, another will take place this year. First, Abidjan hosted the UN Convention to Combat Desertification in May, and then Sharm el-Sheikh will host the UN Climate Change Conference. These are major forums for African states to put on the table the great damage done to parts of the continent due to the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi concluded, "When the representatives of the countries of the world gather at Sharm el-Sheikh in November for COP27, they will hear Western representatives talk about climate change, make pledges, and do everything possible to continue to exacerbate the catastrophe. What we saw in Bonn is a prelude to what will be a fiasco in Sharm el-Sheikh."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Akavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafza Almi of Qum. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
In our previous session, we talked about the faculties that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us and how we can manage all those faculties, be that physical, be that mental, or be that emotional. We mainly talked in the previous session about the physical management, like you said, a parent has to educate himself first and then teach a child about the food, the nutrition his child is taking, about the exercise, the importance of, you know, actually taking care of his body, recreation, going out, the way he looks and the clothing, the hygiene, and all those things we talked in the previous session. What would you like to add in this session?
Yes, we talked about the time management also. That yes. is very important, that one is able to carry out all these activities and manage them in the whole day with proper intervals, intervals where you stop for prayers, recharge yourself, reinvigorate yourself. You start to, because all the day is being used for this, for, in the service of Allah Almighty.
Yes.
I mean, the whole day, it's not just when we're praying that we are worshipping Allah. As I said, the worshipping of Allah Almighty is the special relationship which we have with our Lord,
yes.
Allah Almighty. But the general relationship which is there, we have with our Lord, is in all aspects and in all our relations with any, even ourselves. The special relationship which we have with Allah Almighty is the worshipping, the liturgical, devotional worship that we have, for example, in the form of daily prayers,
mm-hmm.
or the recitation of the Quran, for example. But when we come to all other activities, even when we're taking care of ourselves,
yes,
managing ourselves, our food, our rest, our eating, clothing, resting, going for sports and recreation, and
yes.
all of this is in the should be in the service of Allah, for the sake of Allah. If we are taking food, it should be with this intention that when I take this food,
it
the proper food,
the energy,
it gives me energy, and I continue to be at the service of,
service of Allah, to maintain that special relationship with Allah.
And the general relationship. And when I'm going for my professional life, I'm serving other people. That should be also in the service of Allah Almighty.
All right.
So that is the general relationship which I have with my Allah Almighty.
Okay.
So when we're talking about this time management, we are trying to manage all these things so that we can cover all of these aspects.
True.
One should not be at the expense of the other.
Okay.
My special relationship with Allah Almighty should not be at the expense of my special relationship with my parents.
That's why we call it management.
That's what time management
yes.
is. And parents have to learn it themselves and be able to teach
their
children
the same.
Because if this is done at a very tender age, they know what time they have to wake up. They know when they have to have their food. They know what time they have to go to sleep. Take an afternoon nap, have their studies, or their sports, leisure time, sports, exercise. Everything is according to a...
We will see child developing into something we really wanted them
exactly.
to be. I will be continuing this discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about time management, how you can teach your child to manage the time which is not in our control, the time which is running, the time upon which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears in Quran and says all human beings are in loss unless we do not manage that time. Yes, brother.
So nowadays there are so many tools in the form of applications where you can carry out time management. You can make a weekly chart, a monthly
yes.
chart. So we have to even start learning them and using them. A personal diary should be
maintained
by the parents themselves, and the children should learn how to do that.
Yes.
And especially when it comes to another aspect of managing my own affairs.
Yes.
That is my personal belongings,
mm-hmm.
how I keep my personal belongings, my clothes
yeah.
properly put in the cupboards,
okay.
in the drawers.
When a child is playing and throwing away all those blocks, things, and how he gets all those and collects that and puts them in the place.
In their proper place.
In the proper
place.
The children from
the beginning, they should know,
all
they should
skills.
Be taught, they should be made to do it in a very subtle way. The parents should show them, explain to them, enforce that thing, but they should be made to do it on their own. They should be able to not just mess up things. Yes, they should be allowed to mess up things, playing, everything.
But at the same time,
they should be made to, you know, after the playtime has finished, they should be able to store their playthings in the proper place. They put their shoes in their proper place. They know where to put their coats, the toys, their whatever belongings they have.
And especially like, there are certain children we have seen personally who do certain things at a particular time. They're watching TV as well as they're playing with the blocks. They're playing with the blocks and at the same time they're playing with some ball kind of other kind of toy at the home. So that also has to be managed.
Yes, multitasking, if we're talking about multitasking, girls are better at multitasking than boys.
Yes.
But multitasking is an asset also, but it's difficult. We need to, for example, when we're talking about mental health and mental capabilities, focusing and paying attention is very important.
Yes.
So they have to be taught to be able to focus.
When does multitasking, this focus somehow gets disturbed?
Yes, so we have to be able to manage those things. We have to learn how to get refocus, come back to the point that we're thinking about. I mean, sometimes you have so many things in your mind that you want to do. One has to learn to be able to understand what is more important, which is lesser important, which is going to be...
What is something that's extremely important?
I mean, for example...
Priorities.
Two priorities. One factor is being important,
yeah.
and number two is that it is done on the proper time.
Yeah.
Because if it is done, for example, if you want to drink, if you want to eat ice cream,
mm-hmm.
it should be done immediately. Otherwise, it will start
melting
away.
Yeah.
So some things have to be done at the proper time, but those things have to be done which are important for my goals.
Okay.
So my child has to learn to develop those goals in his mind.
Yeah. And how parents can help more their children in that, I'll talk to you on that note after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about time management, how you can yourself and teach your children time management. But the most important thing that we have been talking throughout the session is that there are certain people we see who are either entirely religious, and when I say that, which means they have only developed one part of their life, that special relationship with Allah, and that has affected their part of other parts of life, like their recreation. They don't go out for recreation, their sporting, their resting time, their leisure time, and their earning as well. But there's a hadith from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, like somebody came to him and told him, like, there is someone who prays 24/7. Which place does he have in heaven? And he says that he'll be in the depth of the hell because he's not helping his family. So that's how we, when we manage time and we teach our children that this is time management, you have to divide all that. And in all the other things, when you're earning, when you're resting, and even when you're going for recreation, you have to have that general relationship with Allah. That should be managed.
Even when we're doing that special devotional practice,
yeah,
that is our special relationship with Allah Almighty, it should be for Allah.
Yes.
Which means that it should not be at the expense of other relations.
Other relationships.
So Allah Almighty does not expect me to be always on the prayer mat.
Yes.
Being on the prayer mat is for a certain time. For example, half an hour in the morning, early morning, dawn.
Yeah.
An hour in the middle of the day, an hour at the end of the day.
And we have to understand that because, as you rightly mentioned in one of the sessions, "Wailun lil musallin."
Exactly.
Allah is like hell with those who pray.
Exactly. So praying should be done at the proper time. One
and
should
maybe
reach
sometimes serving others means.
I mean, the Quran says there are people who are always in a state of prayers.
Yes.
Hum fi salatihim da'imun. They are always praying, which does not mean that
they're all the time on the prayer mat.
No, even when they're talking to other people, they're praying to Allah Almighty. They are obeying Allah's commands. So when it comes to, again, we're focusing on the relationship which a child should have with himself. And
okay,
that is managing his personal belongings, his assets. Gradually, he should be able to manage finances, pocket
okay
money, how to even go out and earn something from the outside, not be always be dependent on pocket money. Yes, pocket money should be given, and how it should be managed for
okay
what he should be able to maintain a record of that.
He should be able to know where from it comes and how.
And he should be able to go and earn something for himself.
Okay.
He should learn that.
Okay.
Then he should be able to take his hobbies, his pastimes. He has certain artistic or aesthetic faculties. They should be developed.
Okay.
He should manage those things.
All right. So all those faculties a child has, he has to learn how to manage them, how to develop. And management of all that comes back to parents who themselves first need to get educated on everything. The best thing was that we are entirely in the process of relationship with Allah, but we have to manage that. We have to see where it is the special one, where it's the general one. Even when we are going out for earning, when we are teaching our child that you have to go and have responsibilities tomorrow, in that as well, we should have khalus, we should have sincerity. That should be all, again, for Allah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.